Nope. Seen it. Oh, nah.
Can't find something to watch? Introducing Sky Stream. It's Sky without the dish. Watch unmissable Sky exclusives like The Regime and Netflix too, all over super reliable Sky full fibre broadband. Get Sky Stream, Sky Broadband and Netflix for just €50 a month. Search Sky Stream. Availability subject location. New customers only. 12-month minimum term. Stream and broadband sold separately. Further terms apply. For more info, see sky.ie/speeds.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave. 1919, 1920. There's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you like the Indo Daily, you can follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
He tried to portray himself as a benign despot for the good of his people. But yeah, he was a bit of a head case, quite simply.
Today on the Indo Daily, Gaddafi, guns and the IRA.
He was an extraordinary character, fancied himself as a bit of a film star, plastic surgery, dyed hair.
A massive Libyan arms shipment to the Provisional IRA in the 1980s had the potential to dramatically escalate the Troubles into a civil war.
The seizure from the Exxent, worth more than £3.5 million, included 1,000 Kalashnikov rifles, 20 SAM-7 missiles, 1 million mortar shells and 10 heavy machine guns.
A new book recounts the capture of the Exxent with 150 tons of modern weaponry from dictator Muammar Gaddafi on board.
It was deeply personal by then, and he just kept stipulating, use them, use them, use them, my only condition.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today I'm joined by John Downing, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, to recall the Exxent gun-running affair. John Downing, the 1980s.
Yeah, a crazy time. The best way maybe to tell this story is I remember mid-1980s going after the pub, buying a few bottles of beer and going around to a friend's house. And there were five or six of us there. We were school contemporaries. I was the only one with a permanent job. I was the only one with a car. They were all actually unemployed, my friends. And at the time, and they were kind of signing on the rock and roll, as we called it, on the dole. And they all had some kind of a little fiddle, which you'd have to have if you were ever to have any kind of a life. But it was a very ramshackle time economically. And it was a very troubled time from the point of view of Northern Ireland. The June 1981 general election, Charlie Haughey lost that election for a number of reasons, but a lot of it was to do with the H-blocks, the hunger strikes. Bobby Sands and nine others starved to death in protest against prison conditions and not getting prisoner of war status as prisoners.
At 17 minutes past one this morning, Mr. Bobby Sands, the IRA MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone, died. Northern Ireland Secretary Humphrey Atkins issued a brief statement saying Bobby Sands had taken his own life by refusing food and medical attention for 66 days. The response in Belfast was immediate and violent.
For light relief, we had Johnny Logan, we had Eurovision wins,
we had Dallas, we had J.R. Ewing.
J.R. Ewing, and we had ABBA, who were actually bigger than Volvo at the time as Sweden's primary export.
And Euro 88 and Jack Charlton rounded off the decade. At the same time, you know, as you mentioned, the hunger strikes at the start of the decade, the IRA's campaign on the mainland as such around London. You saw the Hyde Park bombing, the Harrods bombing, pretty savage attacks there, which caused obvious tensions between London and Dublin. And then we had the absolute brutality of Enniskillen in 1987. Yes.
A Remembrance Day atrocity in Northern Ireland. A bomb has killed 11 and injured more than 60. It was planted a few yards from the war memorial in Enniskillen. It went off without warning. A building collapsed on top of them. 13 children are among the injured.
at the same time, the IRA's arms and where they were getting their munitions from was coming under scrutiny. And I suppose we've a greater understanding now of where all that was coming from.
Absolutely. The IRA were in a very difficult spot in the mid-1980s. They were running out of money. They were running out of arms. They kind of had enough to keep it going as a low kind of irritant in the background, and they reckoned they could keep it going for about 20 years. But they had a major rethink, and they decided they absolutely had to escalate what they were doing. They had to do vastly more of it. They had to be far more brutal. They took their inspiration from what was called the Tet Offensive in 1968 in Vietnam, when the Viet Cong just suddenly and surprisingly pumped up the war. Now, they could not defeat the US, but what they were trying to do was bring a realization to Washington that this really was no longer worth the candle. And the IRA's hope was if they started hell for leather, doing far, far more in the North, but also taking the war to Britain very much more, and even elsewhere in Europe. We had, for example, you know, it later came to fruition, attacks on German bases and the botched attempt to bomb Gibraltar. We had all of these type of things. But how were they going to do that? Where were they going to get the money? Where were they going to get the arms?
A new book out, Gerard O'Faelon, historian and author, A Broad Church, The Provisional IRA and the Irish Republic. Part of the fascinating installment during that period that he goes into is the IRA's relationship with one Colonel Muammar Gaddafi,
indeed,
dictator of Libya.
Indeed. And that was the central answer. I was saying to you, how are the IRA going to step up the war? How are they going to pump up the action? The one word, Libya. And the link with Libya goes back to the early 70s. It came via Breton nationalists. Gaddafi was the guy who had staged a bloodless coup.
The man who led the military coup was a young colonel, Muammar al-Gaddafi. With the same iron fist with which he ruled Libya, 27-year-old Gaddafi kicked out British and US forces from the country and nationalized the oil industry.
He had a visceral hatred of the West more generally, and Britain very specifically. He had supplied arms in the early 1970s. Famously, it came to light in 1973 when a boat called the Claudia was arrested off Waterford, off Helvick. And who was on board? Only Joe Cahill, a veteran IRA man from Belfast, very senior figure. He was among those on board. Gaddafi went cool on the IRA through the latter half of the 70s. The relationship was again rekindled in the 1980s.
Gaddafi was quite a high-profile figure, and part of that was because of his image.
Yeah, absolutely. He was. I suppose you don't get to be dictator of a medium-sized North African country by hiding behind the door. He was an extraordinary character, fancied himself as a bit of a film star, plastic surgery, dyed hair, Lawrence of Arabia type image in his tent, in his Bedouin tent out in the desert. He had his green book. Mao had his little red book. Gaddafi had his green book, his philosophy about life. And he tried to portray himself as a benign despot for the good of his people. But yeah, he was a bit of a head case, quite simply.
During that time, he was effectively a sponsor of terrorism. Lockerbie, after all, that disaster and the bombing of a plane there traveling over Scotland at the time, it directly linked back to Libya and to his regime. So the relationship with the IRA rekindles because you have a series of shipments now, relatively small. As you say, mentioned the Claudia, there was the Casamara, the Kula, the Via, up to the mid-80s. And then the name of a ship that became quite infamous, the Exund.
The Exund, indeed.
Tell us about the Exund.
The There were four shipments on various boats. There was a man called, a very important link in all of this was a travel agent who had gone bankrupt, a man called Adrian Hopkins. He had a company called Bray Travel, which spectacularly went bankrupt, leaving people stranded, leaving people losing their deposits on their holidays, all that sort of stuff. Mr. Hopkins reinvented himself in the shipping business, chartering boats, ostensibly, we were told. But through a friend who was an IRA sympathiser, he made contact with the IRA. Thomas Slab Murphy, who frequently occurs in dispatches about the IRA, he met him in a pub in Dublin called the White Horse. It's on the Quays. It used to be on the Quays, beside the old Irish Press offices, directly across from Liberty Hall. And he gave him fortunes of money. And he was the guy who variously hired boats, bought boats, refurbished them, renamed them. And he had done four, that we know of, successful shipments from Libya. The Exund was going to be the daddy of them all. It would have been the equivalent of the previous four put together. There were a lot of difficulties with it. There were two Donegal trawlermen, and there was the head of the IRA engineering, Gabriel Cleary, who was a man from Talla, very low-key operator. The guards knew about him, but they had never laid a glove on him. He was the main man. He was very, very technically proficient in bomb making and managing explosives and armaments and all of that. And he was the main man in the whole thing. Unlike the previous IRA arms shipments, this thing had to be loaded on board the Exund in port in Tripoli in Libya. And of course, the place was coming down with spies and surveillance of all kinds.
And this was a big shipment. It was hard to hide here. We were looking at Kalashnikovs, heavy machine guns. The SAM-7 missiles were surface-to-air. They were to take down helicopters.
Yes.
The RPG rocket launchers, grenades, ammunition, and Semtex plastic explosive, which featured in a heck of a lot of IRA bombings at this time.
At the Exxon trial, which I subsequently covered in Paris in 1990, the Exxon was described as a travelling warship. It had enough to send, you know, to send half of Ireland into orbit. There was a thing called the SAM-7, which the IRA were obsessed with, because they wanted to take down British Army helicopters, which were, the absolute essential link piece in the occupation of Northern Ireland, bringing troops, personnel, equipment, supplies from one base to another. Very, very of great practical benefit to the IRA in their killing sprees, but also a huge, would have been a huge propaganda coup for them.
Now, Gaddafi is supplying these weapons not so that they can be put into bunkers, but actually be used at the time.
His only stipulation was use them. This was very personal to him by then. In 1986, there was a bombing. The US bombed Tripoli and right at his core. One of his daughters was killed in that bombing. Of course, the British had facilitated the US bombing, so it was deeply personal by then, and he just kept stipulating, use them, my only condition.
So Irish crew is sailing this rather large ship out of the port of Tripoli, but things start to go wrong.
Gabriel Cleary, the IRA's head of engineering, had a terrible pun, unintended sinking feeling about this from the very start. They were being buzzed by RAF aeroplanes. By the time they got as far as Gibraltar in the Mediterranean, one of the planes came down so low that Cleary could actually see the pilot. So he thought that this is not a good thing. And meanwhile, there were engine difficulties, other technical difficulties with the Exxon, its steering was very, very poor, all sorts. So eventually, by the time they get around, out of the Mediterranean, up the Atlantic, up the coast of Spain, Bay of Biscay, so on, they're off the north coast of France. And Cleary says, right, this is it. We're just going to have to. The fallback plan was sink the boat, scuttle it, and go ashore in France on a dinghy, get the train, get the ferry, go home. Mm-hmm. Tell no one. So he had, in that eventuality, Gabriel Cleary had already made an explosive device to sink the boat that would cause maximum damage, minimum kerfuffle to alert the authorities. When he went to find his already made sabotage bomb, he found that somebody had interfered with it. He couldn't use it. So they had to leave the boat. Suddenly they were descended upon by armed French customs who arrested the whole lot of them. The boat was towed into Brest and on we go.
Huge coup for the security services, who were able to say that there was joint cooperation to combat terrorism on the high seas. You recall covering the trial in Paris of these individuals.
Yeah. And they had been in prison. It was March 1990. I was in Paris to cover the trial. Five of them arraigned. They got extraordinarily light sentences. They all spoke. Basically, they praised France, liberté, égalité, fraternité, and all of that. And they said, look, you guys, we have nothing against France. In fact, we got most of our ideas from you guys in France. And look at our flag and look at your flag and so on. So they got very light sentences.
The Irish government's reaction to this, it's curious at the time, because we still have a relationship with Libya during the 1980s, despite Gaddafi being regarded as a pariah.
Yeah, we had a strange sort of symbiotic relationship with Gaddafi. A lot of it was to do with beef. There were contacts. Charlie Haughey in opposition went and visited. Albert Reynolds had considerable business connections before, during and after with Libya. Libya was considered at the time to be, it was oil rich. It was just rich, full stop. Also, there was a huge market there for beef. And Ireland at the time was so abysmally dependent on EU intervention that anywhere that would buy beef from us, and a lot of, they were trying to open markets in the Middle East at the same time. You know, I mean, basically engaging with the gang of toenail pullers and you know, basically thugs of one kind or another, as was Gaddafi also. But
any dictator would do, yeah.
Yeah, basically, if they buy beef, we'll have them.
Mm. And that was the curious thing. So we had this trade and diplomatic relationship with a country and a leader with whom we knew were actually supplying a terrorist organization,
yes,
trying to undermine and, yes, subvert the state.
And some of, I mean, the four earlier armaments brought in by this group, they were landed at Clogha Strand in Wicklow. They were landed at an old roadstone pier that was little used near Arklow. And they were dispersed around the country into bunkers. And the idea, this, if they had brought the Exxon home and its cargo, it was going to be put into one huge bunker somewhere in the southeast. And it would be then later dispersed piecemeal to various smaller bunkers and to what were called ASUs, the active service units, along the border, in the north, and all the rest. Huge doubt within the IRA as to whether they could actually, A, could they do it? And B, even if they did, had they the personnel, had they the expertise, had they the nous to use these things? So it was a mixed bag for the IRA, a time of considerable worry and anxiety for them, let's just say, organisationally.
Irish government went about expressing concerns to the Libyans at that time. Gerry Collins, the famed foreign affairs minister, saying it would have been catastrophic had these weapons reached Ireland, and we're expressing our troubled feelings towards the Libyan regime.
Basically, diplomatically shook their fists at Tripoli, but I don't think Colonel Gaddafi was quaking in his boots as a result of any of that.
And my thanks to John Downing. I'm Fiona Sheehan, and today's episode was produced by Mary Carroll, researched by Saoirse Mulgrew, with sound by Gavin Hennessy. Archive clips from ITV, PBS, ITN, BBC, RTE, the EBU, and Johnny Logan's What's Another Year. If you enjoyed Ian Lowe Daily, don't forget to like, follow, and leave us a review.